Blog Talk Radio.
General quarters. Security condition 3.
GQ. Security 3, sir. General quarters 3. Intruder alert. GQ 3. Intruder alert.
Well, my wonderful doorman says intruder alert, but I know he's been definitely looking forward to this show as much as I have tonight. Now, welcome, of course, once again. You know where you are. You're in the genie's bottle known as Madame Perry Salon. I am your hostess and cruise director, occasional den mother, Madame Perry, or you can call me Jennifer Perry, and I am so thrilled to have you here. And I took a few days off this week. I went to Los Angeles. A client of mine, Jennifer Irwin, an author, we had her book launch party at a place called Kelly Eye Designs in Redondo Beach. And the owner, Kelly, she's an interior decorator, but she sells all kind of art and clothing and wonderful things in her shop. So she hosted it in her shop. And the book, Jennifer Irwin's book, is called A Dress the Color of the Sky, and it deals with a woman who's going into rehab for sex addiction. The film rights have already been purchased even before she signed a publishing contract, so that was pretty exciting. We've got the publisher, producer, Annette Stevens. I got to meet her last night as well, or the night before last while I was in Los Angeles as well. And I don't know. They're not letting me say a whole lot, but I do know that on the website they have mentioned Bradley Cooper for the lead in this film, and don't know who all else, but it should be very good. So Dress the Color of the Sky by Jennifer Irwin. She had a fantastic night. I think she sold about 200 books, something. It was amazing. Also, it's Glass Spider Publishing. It's a publisher, and if you're looking to submit to a publisher, I think they're a small press, at least they are now. They will be big very soon because this book is taken off like mad. Glass Spider Publishing is definitely a class act among publishers, so check them out too. Recently, going over some shows, recently we had Toni Green on. Toni Green is a psychic medium, and she's got several books and has she's got a TV show, radio shows. Toni Green, I hadn't even checked back into the studio and find out that Toni's show has gotten a lot of downloads. I think I've had 5,700 people have downloaded that show since she was on last, I believe it was Tuesday or Wednesday. That's pretty exciting. And then coming up soon, I'm going to have a guy, Pat Duggins, who's covered all of the NASA missions for years for NPR. He's going to be on in a couple of weeks. And everything is just coming up. I'm getting more and more fun guests, publishing's on my mind. Sponsors, and it's all because of you, because you listen to my show, you subscribe, you share it with your friends, you download it, whether you listen to it on Blog Talk Radio, Player FM, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Blueberry, whatever your choice to listen to podcasts. The point is that you do and you subscribe, and I am so grateful to you. I really appreciate you, and that makes me able to get more exciting people coming on. So, and tonight, you know what I'm going to say now? I'm going to say tonight is definitely no exception. This is a guest I've wanted to have on for quite a long time, and a lot of people have been anticipating this as much as I have. So what can I tell you about him? Well, let's see. He is a writer, educator, activist. He's a native New Yorker. He's a poet and author. His poems and essays have been published in a variety of books and journals. his book, he's got a book that's very popular called, that he wrote with his partner, Joseph, and I'm not even going to say his last name until my guest comes in here, who wrote and edited the book with him. It's called Our Naked Lives, Essays from Gay Italian American Men. It's a collection of 15 personal essays from 15 men about being gay and Italian American. And just so you know, he has an essay in this book, but just so you know, if you look back through some history, and history that's not too far in the distance back there, Italian Americans had just as much difficulty, just as much prejudice, and just as much mistreatment as any other group of gays in America. And a lot of people don't know that. I had a guest on the show once. He's been on a few times, Ray D'Africo. And when he first spelled his name for me, he said, well, my grandparents had to take the apostrophe after the D apostrophe A-F-R-I-C-O because they wanted it to sound or look less Italian because of the prejudice that they were dealing with at the time. So there's a lot of things, if you look back a little bit in history, a lot of things we're not aware of. But anyway, as I was saying, his essays have appeared in White Crane, Stranger to These Shores, and various anthologies, articles in Gay City News and the Huffington Post. He was awarded the Editor's Poetry Prize for his work in Gay City Volume 2. He writes on personal, political, and social topics and issues, including marginalized peoples and literatures, especially, as I said, Italian Americans and people of the gay, lesbian, and bisexual, and transgender, and queer, the GLBTQ community. So, you know, I have a strong interest here. In fact, my husband's always saying, I love my wife. She wants to champion every group. She wants to champion the GLBTQ group. He goes, he's always so proud of me. So why don't I just go ahead and say, I am thrilled to have here in Madame Perry's salon, and let me get his microphone turned on. Wait, he seems to have disappeared. I think he's coming back in. Oh, you are here. Can't see you.
I am.
My guest. Michael Carasone. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm very honored and flattered.
I am delighted to be here. You know, I first found you on Instagram, and we share a mutual friend, Colin Kelly, my dear friend Colin.
Yes.
And I first started, I was just very intrigued by your post in Instagram, and I thought, okay, here's a like-minded individual who has a lot to say and who says it well, intelligently, with confidence and power, and I just had to start following you and getting to know you better. So, once again, another benefit of social media is finding people that you might not have ever had the chance to know, with whom you can identify a similar spirit or feeling.
Absolutely. Social media is great. It really is, but the other side of it is you never really meet some of these people either in real life. But I hope to meet you in real life one day.
Oh, I hope so too. And I get the feeling we will. You know, like I said, when I was out on the West Coast this week for a client event, I mean, I've known this woman for a while, met her through Twitter, and then she hired me to your book publicist, but yet we had not met. She'd been on the podcast on Madame Perry's Salon a year ago, but this is the first time we had actually met in real life, and also a lot of her friends. So, yeah, you never know, but it makes the world a lot smaller place, doesn't it? And it certainly has broadened my life to meet so many more people. There's always a downside to it, like everything. You know, you can abuse anything. God knows I've been way too liberal with my use, making it an abuse of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. But you know, it's how you approach things, you know.
Absolutely, that's funny. Absolutely, better to abuse chocolate chip cookies than.
Look, I've got to, you know, admit my faults before I can point at anybody else, right? So, yeah. Was that last? That's why I was telling somebody recently, I think it was the horror writer in London, Jasper Bart, and I said, you know, sometimes I get to where I hate to read the news in the morning, but sometimes during the night, if I'm up, if the dogs wake me up to go out, I'll think, oh, don't go look at the news feed on my iPad, and I think, oh, why not? Because you know, if 45 has goaded Kim, North Korea into bombing us, why not get up and have 2 extra containers of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream? You know, Häagen-Dazs can put all the calories they want there. That's not going to matter. We're all going to fry, you know? So.
So your last supper is Häagen-Dazs and chocolate chip cookies. Good for you.
Probably, yeah. I started doing a CrossFit type exercise a couple years ago, and you know, they have these big things like the mud run and all these kind of power things people go through, and they say, you know, they have a strict diet, and well, you know this, but good God, I've seen pictures, you know, I've seen the photos of you, you know, you're just temptation.
Yeah,
I mean, you're just
I don't eat chocolate chip cookies. I haven't had a cookie in years.
Oh, I'm talking about the ice cream with chocolate chip cookie dough in it. I'm talking about the ice cream.
I haven't had ice cream.
No.
Yeah. I haven't had ice cream in years.
Well, thank you. I feel even worse about my my lack of self-restraint right now. But.
Eat all the ice cream you want. I got to start eating ice cream, too.
Well,
especially
on,
the world is coming.
The world is coming to an end. Might as well go out like that, you know. I've done well. Like I said, when I started with the CrossFit training, and they have those big runs and things that people do, like some kind of obstacle course, and they say at the end, you know, because you're always on this diet, so man, you have like the one cheat day a week, and they say at the end, your friends will be there at the end to hand you a nice cold beer. I don't drink beer. Just hand me some ice cream. Just. I want my husband to be there waiting with my ice cream. Yeah, baby, you made it.
I'd rather ice cream than beer too, but once I know the end of the world, like our last day, then I'll start eating ice cream, because who cares about having ab muscles, right? So
I don't think you have any problem, Michael. I think you can eat it all week. No, yeah, you're just.
I don't have a problem now, but if I start eating, I could eat. I would love to eat ice cream every night. anyway.
You know, well, so would I, but I have to hold back. Hold back. Gotta be self-disciplined, and I need to be careful, because I don't want you then to go on saying, you know, Jennifer Pear. I was on Madame Perry's salon, and she really took too many liberties how she talked. You know, I don't need any kind of a.
No, I'm actually vegan, so I can't eat cow's milk, dairy ice cream, but I used to love the tofu ice cream, which sometimes has even more sugar than. Dairy ice cream, and but I haven't had that in years, because sugar is very bad. Sugar is very bad for me, anyway.
I know. Yeah. I fight that fight against that white powder, those white crystals every day. I really do. So
white powder is bad in all its forms.
So now that we're in here and warmed up, first of all, I want to say your partner, Joseph, would you pronounce his last name for me?
LaJudice.
LaJudice. Okay. Thank you. I just, and Joseph, I apologize. I just didn't want to mispronounce it. I figure it's probably enough in my accent anyway for you to understand it, but LaJudice. Thank you, Joseph. So tell me, now right now, you're a teacher. Or a professor right now. You're a doctor. The information I have, you're a doctoral fellow in PhD program in English at St. John's University in Queens, New York City.
Yes.
And
I'm I actually recently finished my coursework and passed my exam, so I'm actually ABD, or all but dissertation. Anyway, I'm still a PhD student, yeah, but I completed a milestone, and I'm just starting the dissertation, which I want to rush through and finish quickly, and I want to just get out. And but I'm not a full-time professor. I just part-time adjunct professor.
Are you a tough professor?
I was in the past. I used to, well, yeah. So it depends on. I think it more depends on the class I'm teaching. So I tend to be more tough when I teach composition and writing, because it's so important that that they develop those skills, and they're usually
mm-hmm.
freshmen. But I taught writing a long, long time, and I'm happy not to. this might sound horrible to some people, but I'm happy not to be teaching it right now. If anyone who teaches writing knows that you need a break. It's exhausting. But I'm actually teaching a graduate level education course to full-time teach, like middle school and high school teachers who are earning a master's degree. So I don't really have to be as tough or strict with them. You know, they're adults, professionals, they're teachers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a course on diversity. So I haven't taught writing in a few semesters, and I've been teaching education, which is a nice change.
It sounds like you enjoy it.
I do enjoy it. I taught high school English for 8 years, from 97 to 2000, or 98 to 2006, something like that. And then I had another full-time office job. But I've been teaching at part-time at the college level since 1999, on and off. Sometimes it was extra income, sometimes it was my only income, like now. And I enjoy teaching, but
mm-hmm.
it's extremely exhausting. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a totally different animal. It's not a desk job.
Mm-hmm.
It's exhausting. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of work outside of the classroom. So.
Oh yeah.
But.
Mhm.
No, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay. No. Okay. I thought you were going into another another talk. Well,
I like what happens.
Let me ask you this.
Goes, yeah. Go ahead.
No, please keep going.
I like what happens inside the classroom. I enjoy thinking and discussing, and I think the classroom, it can be a very artificial place, because, you know, in real life, 25 adults don't get together and theorize. Although
mm-hmm.
that would be great if that really happened in real life. Maybe the world would be a better place. But I kind of like that time stops in a way in a classroom, and you come together and you talk about ideas. So that's what I've always loved about teaching. But especially being a part-time faculty is difficult because it's a lot of work, and I'm only paid for classroom hours, so everything I do outside of the classroom I'm not paid for, so the whole university system really exploits us, and the pay is very low. Sometimes I do the math and it's like I'm making $10 an hour. And I can go back and work in retail and make 15. But you know, no one is coming into a store to discuss ideas, you know, so but American higher education is, you know, it's really problematic because it's become a big business and it's exploiting its workers just like other corporations. So that's it's sometimes difficult just to think that you're a college instructor, or even if it's a part-time professor, and you're supposed to be respected, but you're really disrespected, you know. And American society is anti-intellectual anyway, so it's constant disrespect.
That's amazing. I would think, or I would hope that it would be different. Now, I went to college, got my degree much later. I mean, I think the other students in class, I think I was older than their parents when I went. And
that's great,
I remember
though.
Being just, yeah, I was so thrilled to be there, Michael, and just so thrilled to finally get in and get going with this. And I remembered some of the students would come in and say, and their first, you know, their first, well, not, they wouldn't go first day, the second day, they would say things like, do we have to buy the book? Do we have to come to class? Do we have to this? Do we have to that? And I remember just being astounded.
They still ask those questions. The freshmen still ask those questions. It hasn't changed. I'm very happy not to. I'm not this semester. I'm not teaching undergraduates, especially freshmen. So I'm very happy because I need that change every now and then of, like, you know, having more mature, older, professional students. You know, it's nice. It's nice to just be in a room with some adults and just talk, like, just like I said, just talk about ideas in a mature way. I mean, that's really what, you know, that's what university is supposed to be about. It's kind of changed, but so. Thank you for letting me vent. This is a wonderful therapy session.
Well, you know, most people listen to this. You know, people will say, you know, usually when you get an interview, and I'm sure this happens to you too. You know, the producer, somebody will say, okay, well, is your publicist going to send talking points or questions? You know, for things. And I used to do, because I remember when I worked for years ago when I did get out of college with my journalism public relations degree, I did some work for HBO documentaries, and one thing I did was, for the premieres, one thing I did was to set up the media tours like this, with, you know, radio or podcast with people, and I'd give the talking points to the person being interviewed and to the interviewer, and I would have to stay on the phone and listen to both sides, but mute myself out, but listen to both sides to make sure everybody stayed on message. And now sometimes I'll get guests who will have talking points, or their manager or whatever send talking points. And then sometimes, you know, it's kind of like goes with the thing because they want to present certain things, and I understand that. And then there'll be some that'll give me talking points, and I'll ask a question. They'll go, God, that's a weird question. I don't know why you'd ask me that. Can we look around your list? You know, or somebody give me a list of dates where they're playing that year. And I see you're going to be in Atlanta playing at this So we hadn't announced that yet. You know, well, you should have put it on the paper. You know? But then again, so that's why sometimes when people say, oh, no, don't do it, just kind of go, you know, like you, just this go organic, whatever happens, I'm thinking, okay, this is going to go very well or not well at all. So fortunately with you, it's going very well. And speaking of such, if you're listening live tonight, I want you to know, yes, I am talking to author, educator, and activist Michael Carasone. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's fine. You pronounced
that's
it
fine.
Very.
It's not yet.
No, you pronounced it very correctly. No, it's great. I mean, that's how I pronounce it. I'm not used to people pronouncing my name correctly. I'm used to being called so many other things. So, no, that's great. I didn't expect you to pronounce it with the Italian accent, and I mean, neither do I, so.
Well, I've got some Sicilian in my background, you know. So,
okay,
you know.
Cool. That's great.
Every vowel matters, yeah. So, anyway, so if you're listening live tonight, you can call in and talk to Michael. The number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. And Blog Talk Radio assures me that's a toll-free number within the continental U.S. So we'll be here to talk to you, so feel free to call. So let me ask you then, let's go to, now that we've got you warmed up, what do we want to talk about first? We want to talk about books, your writing. Let's talk about Our Naked Lives, Essays from Gay Italian American Men. Now, that's a collection of 15 essays, 15 men about being gay and Italian-American. You have one essay in the book, right?
Yes.
But you and your partner, Joseph Logidice, please, one more time?
Logidice.
Logidice, thank you.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Well, how did you get the idea? Who came up with the idea for putting this book together, these essays, and your theme, and how did you choose the people whose work was included?
It was my idea many years ago. I was writing my thesis, my master's degree in English, and after choosing quite a few topics that were unsuccessful, I went to my advisor and I asked her if I could write about Italian American literature, and I didn't want to ask her that at first because I didn't think she would say yes. I didn't think the department would think it was worthy, because I know that in the scholarly world of literature, it's not seen as worthy. So she was also Italian-American, but I still didn't want to ask her that. And I had so many other ideas for a thesis that I knew would be accepted because they were either well-respected authors, or they were, you know, works of literature in the canon, or they were seen as something worthy. But I finished my coursework really quickly, and then I was struggling for about a year. I didn't know what to write my thesis on. And the more I waited and failed at it, then more time would pass and I wouldn't get my degree. So I went to her and I said, finally, I don't remember the exact, but finally she said, okay, so that didn't work out and that didn't work out. She said, but what do you really want to write about? So I said, I really want to write about why Italian American literature is disrespected and marginalized. And she said, mm-hmm. great, I want to read that, go do it. So I went to do it, and I took a long time. I left the program. I went into another master's degree program, got another master's degree, then came back to the program, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I spent a long time researching and writing. I wrote a really long thesis, and while I was researching, I accidentally found only two collections of two books that were collections of various types of writing by and about LGBT Italian Americans. And there were only two, and then many years later when I published my book is only the third. There are only three books, not three books that are about us or by us, but three collections that have multiple voices recorded. So after my thesis was approved and I graduated and I got my degree, Joseph and I were talking and we started brainstorming ideas about this book. And that was in 2007. And we wrote an entire nonfiction book proposal, and we sent it to many or most of the gay publishing companies, and we were either ignored, they never replied, or they rejected it. And that alone is another essay for me to write one day. So the gay publishers the gay publishers rejected us, which I wasn't surprised, and I knew why they rejected us. And it wasn't until 2013 that a small independent scholarly press that only focuses on Italian American content published our book. So it took the Italian American publisher to publish a book about being gay and Italian American, and that surprised me because the press didn't surprise me because it's not any sort of conservative press, but what surprised me was that the Italian American community that tends to be evolved, but that tends to be conservative, really really welcomed our book into the world and was excited about it. And the gay male community was not as excited. Definitely a fascinating study that I would like to publish one day, but I think I know the answer.
Really, because I'm just going to say I may not have a deep understanding of literature in both groups and publishers there, but the armchair sociologist in me, would definitely want to know more.
I think it's because I would say it's because Italian American gay men are just automatically, because we can pass as white, so we're just dumped into the white gay male category, and then we can easily be ignored. And only in that gay male world, you know, there are, if you're not a white gay man, then you fall into very few other groups. And I know from my own experience and from others' experiences, I mean, the gay male world is still, I would say, very much dominated or controlled by that Anglo identity, and Italian or Italian American gay men are very much objectified, just seen as sexual objects, and there's no reason for them to, you know, say or produce anything intelligent.
So, and I don't see this, you know, and even though, you know, I'm a straight white female, you know, my husband and I are very involved in a lot of gay communities, activities, and support groups. And, you know, I was very unaware of that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's very normal for you to be unaware of that because,
mm-hmm.
right, because your identity is so, gay men don't come up to you and say certain things to you that they would say to me or that they say to me without
uh-huh.
any sort of hesitation, right? So, you know, gay men aren't coming up to you and treating you as some sort of erotic toy, you know, that's all.
Right. So that's got to be a very, I don't know, help me with the word here, I would say disrespectful or debasing type of feeling or attitude.
Absolutely. Well, it is. And, you know, it's sort of, I don't really know how to talk about it or don't want to talk about it a lot because I don't want people to think of it as like being I don't want people to think I'm being arrogant or cocky or vain and that I'm saying that, you know, I'm this sexy thing that, and like it's so difficult to be, you know, sexy or because I read these articles and where gay men talk about, you know, the problems with let's just say, like, being seen as a sex object or good looking. And then I read comments, if they're, like, posted on Facebook, and other gay men are, like, so cruel. And they're, like, they say things like, oh, it must be really tough to be good looking. And they miss the
mm-hmm.
point. And you know,
yes.
My point is it's not about looks. Also for me, and I just had this conversation with a professor actually this week, Tuesday. For me, I happen to also be living and working in academia, an academic world that you know, that doesn't take well to good-looking people, if you want to put it like that. So my point
mm-hmm,
is
mm-hmm.
I am constantly by colleagues or students or peers, by my own professors. I'm also a student, but I am always being insulted or sexualized or objectified. I deal with microaggressions constantly every day that I'm in academia because they don't see me as an intelligent person. Or if I say something intelligent, they're surprised because there's no reason for me to be intelligent. Or I've had fellow female students or female professors say things to me like, you know, you look great. Did you just come from the gym? Oh, yes. You know, you look buff and sweaty. Or I remember I was at a student at Teachers College years ago, and the classroom was hot, and I said, wow, it's hot in here. And one of the other students, and we were adults, you know, we were graduate students, she said, well, I wouldn't mind if you take off your shirt. And, you know, I laugh, and it's a joke, but mm-hmm. I think to myself, can you imagine if I said that to her, like, you know, hey,
yeah.
You're hot, take off your shirt. But so my point is that white gay men, but not only white gay men, but Asian, Latino, Black, all varieties of gay men constantly reduce me to something only sexual, or I still get the whole exotic thing, or questions like, are you Italian where it counts, or, you know, let me see your sausage and stuff like that. You know, all of those, I don't even know what you would call them, but the stereotypes. I mean, I stopped going to gay bars years ago because it's like, you know, talking about sexual harassment, it's like how much groping can you really take anymore? So I'm not surprised that gay men wouldn't care about my book or my work because I'm not supposed to be anything more than their sex toy.
You used a lot of interesting terms in here. So I wrote down, taking notes, microaggression, which that's a new term for me. But I can see that, and I can see what you're saying in so many ways. You know, when people talk about the current scandal, you know, the Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, and everything coming back out with that about the, you know, the casting couch and the all the stories about the just a heinous bad behavior and brutality of that type of world where people can get away with it. And
right.
Somebody says, you know, well, why haven't women spoken up? Well, you know, it's one of those things where if you haven't been there, you really don't get it.
Right.
You know, like you telling me this, these are things I would not know because I'm not, you know, a member of that culture of Italian American gay men. And you know, I know that my like my best friend is a Black woman, and sometimes when people say things that maybe a Black person doesn't take something well or misinterpret something or is easily offended, and I go, well, you know, you don't know what they've seen or what they've heard, what they've been through, and what kind of signals they see that we don't grasp. You know, I was a kid that grew up, you know, with the saying, you know, oh, you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny. Well, I had the frizzy red hair and glasses and flat, and my mother dressed me in things way too big because she was, I don't know, terrified that, I don't know what they thought I was going to do. You know, they thought that was going to keep me out of trouble. You know what trouble meant in those days?
Right.
And and all this stuff. So I was always it's like I was to get every single day was just a gauntlet of insults for me. You know, like, hey girl,
right.
You've been bobbing for French fries. You know, because I had acne. Hey girl, you need to go to Joe's Amico. They fix flats. It's like every single day. It was like the kid in the movie Mask, and I purely hated every single day of school. I hated every day because it was on and on and on. Then later, you know, I go on. Years later, you know, I learn how to take care of my frizzy hair, and I get rid of braces, you know, and I have contacts. And then all these people are coming out. Well, hey, how you doing? You know, you're looking good. You want to go out? Hell no, I don't want to go out with you. You treated me like crap. What am I supposed to do? Can I prize now? You know? And, no, of course not. And I remember I did not go to class reunions until about the 15th one, and I was married to my husband, so we went. And I had told him some of the horror stories, you know, about being made to stand up on a bus and have stuff thrown at me, and he said, who did that? I said, these people. And they didn't recognize me, and so guys were trying to flirt, and I go, you know, you've always been an ass to me. No, I haven't. I don't even know who you are. You know, you've never met me. And I thought, oh, gosh, the tricks I could play, you know. Except for one guy did apologize to me in a roundabout way, but I think it's because the movie Flatliners had just came out. So he probably had nightmares from that, you know. But then I was trying to tell that people would be, there was always some little thing you could do. You know, you try to look nice and go to work. Oh, well, you think because you're looking. Now, I've spent all these years of being made fun of because I was, you know, flat, had glasses and frizzy hair, you know, and crooked teeth. And now it's like, oh, you think you're something because, you know, you look good or you wear this kind of
right.
dress or whatever.
Right.
You know, you fit into a size 6 and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, where did everything go? Wait a minute, what? And then it would get even smaller into, you know, Southerners are stupid because there were a lot of people from the Midwest who were working at this company and who were in management. It was a company that came from the East Coast, Pactel, the cellular company, moved to Atlanta, so we were working there. And to them, everybody that had a Southern accent was an idiot.
Of course. Of course, right.
And
so
we
you had to deal with
all... And we were all idiots.
Right.
Yeah.
So you had to deal with those stereotypes, too.
Yeah, so there's always going to be something. You know, there's always going to be somebody that's going to find something about another group. You know,
right.
Like when I went to cosmetology school, I was working in a salon in a Tony part, sophisticated part or whatever, moneyed part of Atlanta in the morning, and they'd go, oh, she lives out in Gwinnett County, the boonies. She's, you know, redneck.
Right.
Then I'd leave them there and go to school out in Gwinnett County, and they'd go, oh, you're a city gal, ain't you? Well, we don't like city gals around here. And I thought, is this like an aberration child? You know, I mean, I know that's a very, you know, it's not like an admiration child, but you feel like you're like, I'm going from culture to culture every day.
Right.
And each
right.
one says like, oh, we don't like, you know, you're a hick, and then you're a city gal. It's like, what the heck? Just people, you know, or at this job, though, even though I was an ignorant Southerner to them, I could put on a pair of reading glasses, which were, you know, even though I wore contacts, I put on some readers. Oh, I didn't know you wore glasses, you know, like, so that gives me, a couple of IQ points. It's like, you know, and it's just amazing how people will come up with things, how they're going to see everybody in this little microcosm of how they can put them down. And even one person, it doesn't matter where you know, like I went from one place to another place to another place, you know, to where I lived, where I worked, in school, and everyone had a different prejudice against me. And I thought, my God, that's what I go through, you know. And, okay, so here I am, you know, white, straight, and here. Think about people who are in smaller groups than mine or more minority groups than I'm in. You know, they must really, if this is what I'm going through, I can't imagine what they go through. You know, just like you're saying, you know, Italian-American gay men, you know, I would have had no idea about being that. And, yes, all the little things, too, the little comments that people say, I remember people would say, you know, there's always somebody ready to make a comment to a woman. Like, I know my girlfriend Kenya and I, we met at this one job we had about 20 years ago, and we would both be hit on by guys. And if we said anything to a manager, you know, the woman's the problem. She brought it on herself.
Right.
I don't know, because Kenya and I both have, well, we're not flat-chested. Well, look, it's not like we did it on purpose, you know. It's not like
that's your anatomy. That's just the way it is. Exactly.
There ain't much I can do about this, you know, without something going to taking everything apart. You know, and why should I? Why should I have to do that just so some people won't harass me or harass her? And I go, God, Kenya, you and I are such freak magnets. Any perv is going to come up to us. You know, what is it, you know? Or even when we went to, and this will be my last story, and I'll get back to you. Even when she and I went together, and we've taken several trips together for different things, when we went together to I was singing the national anthem at a, are you ready for this? The Monster Truck Jam in Alabama.
Wow.
And she went with me. So when the two of us go up the first day, you sing on Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, and then Sunday, because they have three different events for the weekend. And so she and I go up to the place so I could check in, let them know the anthem singer's here. And they come to get us. They go, oh, the anthem singer's here. And they go to her. And ignore me. And they go, you're the one that's going to sing.
I got
and
it.
She shows out of it and she says, listen, we don't all sing.
And let me guess, they thought she was going to do a gospel rendition of the national anthem too, right?
Oh, yeah. They figured she was going to be just giving some kind of Aretha thing, you know.
Exactly. Listen, we don't. That
was
perfect reply. Listen, we don't all sing.
Oh, she's She's brilliant, and she's one. She's a wonderful person, you know. She's always we just have a wonderful. Every time we go on these trips, but we always have plenty of laughs. But she just looks at him. No, we don't all sing. So, and I looked at me. You sing? Yes. But yet, it's always easy. And then for people to find, there's going to be some hole. And then of course, Michael, then it has to make, then I think when I get aggravated with it, that's probably the time where I need to stop and think, okay, what am I doing? You know, am I looking at somebody and thinking they're this or that because of a prejudice I may have or something that I'm already thinking about a group of people?
Right.
Yeah, because we all do it whether we know it or not, I think.
True. I do think other people do it a lot more than I do.
I'm trying to be.
I'm very aware of it. You know, I mean, I'm very aware of stereotypes because I'm usually, you know, the one who's being in a way mistreated because of this stereotype, and I'm also aware of that because I've, you know, been researching, reading, teaching about these things. But I mean I know that in the gay community, Black and Latino men are also objectified a lot, but I don't do that because I know better. Like, I don't only see Black and Latino men as, you know, sex objects, and I don't obey the stereotypes, dick size and whatever, stuff like that. So I don't want to live with those stereotypes. I sometimes am quite shocked that, you know, it's almost 2018 and many people still believe these stereotypes, and that's frustrating and it's frightening and it's infuriating, you know.
I was reading out in print, Queer Book Reviews, a review of Our Naked Lives, Essays from Gay Italian-American Men, that you, Michael Carasone, and your partner, Joseph Logitice, created and edited. And did you like this review? Because I want to read something from it.
Okay.
Did you read this review?
I did. I read this book was not a New York Times bestseller, of course. It sold a good amount of copies for what it is. We were number 11 on the small press distribution list when it first came out. That's a major accomplishment, achievement for that. We knew. I mean, We made very few dollars off of this book. It wasn't a $1 million book deal. We're not wealthy. I think we made a couple of $100 in royalties, whatever. We knew that this wasn't going to be a bestseller. It's extremely written for a very small audience. That doesn't mean that only gay Italian American men read it. A lot of other types of people read it, but so the book wasn't reviewed a lot, but it was reviewed enough. And I have problems with all of the reviews because all of the reviews got it wrong in one way or another. And I would have liked to have talked to each reviewer and slapped him first and then asked him, because I don't think a woman reviewed it, I think just men. I really would like to have asked them if they really read it, you know, carefully and thoroughly, because I don't think they did. But look, the book is going to be 5 years old. It's done with. I never contacted those people. I said thank you. I was very gracious to two or three of them because, of course, I'm grateful that anyone reviewed the book. But they just, and even one reviewer was a gay Italian American man, and he did it for a scholarly journal. I think each review just really missed something that was poignant or profound that they shouldn't have missed, but they did. But as a writer, I'm moving on to my next project, you know. That book is in my past, and I'm not going to, I don't want my entire writing career to be based on one book, so I move on. And I also have to constantly, for me, it's a constant fight and struggle to tell folks that I am a writer. Gay male writers don't take me seriously.
Gay male writers don't what? Mine.
Take me seriously. They only take my photos seriously. But anyway, yeah, definitely ask me a question about that one. Sorry.
Okay, well, a couple things I have to say to you. First of all, and this little—I don't know if you can hear this voice that keeps coming in and telling me how many seconds I've got left. It always can you? I don't know if you can hear it.
No,
that's why
I can't.
It keeps coming in during certain sentences. So that's why I've stopped. It's not that I'm not listening to you. This woman keeps interrupting me with this recorded voice. And I swear to you, it's not that. And I know what you're probably thinking. I know what some people that listen are probably thinking. They're probably thinking, "Oh yeah, do you have a knife and fork that go with that plate in your head?" No, it's not that, okay? I swear, it's that voice. 2 minutes left, that's the voice, okay. But so if I understand, you don't always, you know, think of yourself, express yourself as a writer, but I'm going to have to say something, you know, because I've come to enjoy you so much from meeting you as it were, on Instagram and reading their posts, and I've just come to admire you and respect you and enjoy you so much on there that, are you sitting down?
Yes.
Okay, I really do want you to come back and talk more about your writing and work, if you don't mind.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely.
Please. Okay,
sure.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's
Yay!
Do it again.
Okay. Yay. Good. Okay. Yes, I definitely want you back to get to talk about it. But I think this was the review. It's by Lloyd A. Meeker. And what was the thing? It says, there was a line further up ahead. I'm going to just take out a couple of pieces out of a couple of paragraphs here that really stand out. And also because, you know, I'm going to read the whole thing, and if you're interested, you go look it up, folks, and read it for yourself and get the book. But there was one thing, as I think it's in the third paragraph, as Frank Anthony Polito in his essay Italian-American Reconciliation concludes, I hate to think of my grandfather leaving this world without knowing who I truly am, and yet I can't bring myself to broach the subject. Is it because I'm ashamed of being gay? I don't think so. I think it's because I'm proud of being Italian-American. And then the next one he talks about, you know, the recurring things of cultural insularity, family obligation, religious paradigms serving as landmarks in the individual journey recounted in each man's words. But then down below, I think there's this thing where he says, a paragraph, the essays are educational in the way education often comes best through firsthand stories, acquired knowledge imparted by one to another. And but then toward the end, though, he says, I strongly recommend this collection, a nourishing, thought-provoking, and deeply emotional exploration of exclusion and inclusion, structure and obligation, love, fear of losing love, the withholding of love, the nourishment and danger of extended family relationships seen through a gay and uniquely Italian-American lens. And so you feel like that paragraph gives a good, you know, just a good thumbnail definition?
Yes. Yes. I think what all of the reviewers what they didn't see or what they didn't notice or what they forgot or what they got wrong was that what we wrote in the introduction was that the essence of the book was about these men having these two identities. Of course, we all have multiple identities, and we discussed more identities in the book, but the real, like, to put it briefly, the essence of the book was about these men having two identities, and these two identities never made us feel like we belong in either world or community. This these identities were more in conflict than in harmony. And I don't remember any reviewer really understanding that, because I don't think many people understand what it feels like to have multiple marginalization and the feeling that you never fit in or belong, because, you know, we try to at least fit in or belong to one sort of group, right? But, you know, certain identities don't. So black gay men talk about the fact that racism exists in the gay community, and it does, and how they feel like they belong more to their black community than to their gay community. And that's definitely, by now it has to be fact, because it's been talked about and written about and observed so many times that, you know, there's all this data that suggests, you know, this is real. They don't feel sometimes they don't feel as unwelcomed in their racial community as they do in their sexual community. But the point of this book was the question, what do you do when you're not really sort of welcomed in any of your communities or your identities, or what if your certain communities welcome you, but that invitation is superficial, or it's limited, or it's based on stereotypes, you know? So I'm welcomed into my gay male community as so far as I can, you know, fuck these other gay men, and, you know, I'm just being used for that. You know what I mean? So, So, yeah, the book reviews were lovely, but I think that they missed how profound these 15 essays were in trying to explain deeper issues. You know, we weren't just talking about, you know, it wasn't just about the usual. It wasn't about family, and some of the reviews were, you know, just superficial. Like we were writing about family and religion and food and blah blah blah. That, I mean, those were wonderful descriptions and narratives in these essays, but we were writing about, you know, real dark. Some of these issues were just, you know, dark, deep human issues that they weren't taken seriously.
Well, I'm going to have to say, you know, you've been so generous with your time tonight, and I know I've run over time and taken more time from you than I told you I would, and I'm very grateful for that, and I hate to stop now. So, you know, I have you on record here as saying that you will come back. So
I
we
will,
can continue
yeah.
this. But I do have one more question to ask that I want to know before I leave, and to bring us back. How did you meet Joseph?
Joseph and I met 13 years ago in traffic, driving from Brooklyn into Manhattan, and we were stopped next to each other.
Really?
So you know when they say you have to go to a bar to meet people, or you have to go to speed dating, or you know you meet people at the cooking class? That's all bullshit. You meet people anywhere and everywhere. It's in traffic. As long as you're awake and aware and present, and you're in the moment, and you observe, and you see, you know, a hottie next to you, and you make a move. I mean, that's really it. 'Cause I'm not doing the online dating, and you don't really meet anything but a hookup at a bar, you know, and I don't want to take a cooking class, so there you go. Talk about stereotypes and the silliness. Yeah.
So was this in New York?
Yes, we.
You're in traffic.
Yes, we both lived in Brooklyn at the time. We were both in our cars, driving into, and we were in Manhattan, stuck in traffic. He was. Yeah, he was in his car by himself, next to mine, a little further back next to mine, and I was in the car with two of my friends who were actually two of his friends, and he noticed. He noticed them in the car, so he texted one of them and said, "Why are you in that car? Who is that driving?" So he was nosy. He asked questions. We all met later on for dinner. It was a horrible, we had horrible first impressions, but then he and I met the next day for coffee.
Oh.
So there you go.
That's a wonderful story.
Thank you.
That is really a wonderful story. Couldn't have made that up. So that's fantastic. Well, I hope to meet you both when I hope we might get back to New York again. And again, I know I've kept you over time, and I'm so grateful to you for making the time and being so generous with your time with me, Michael. And if you're listening, folks, I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. And yes, he is coming back, and I'm so happy to hear it. And this is where we say goodbye and I give a parting words to people. Michael, where I tell everybody to be nice to each other. And so what would your parting words be?
My parting words would be hope and fight.
Yeah. Bugs.